You're listening to a podcast from 702.
Clark, and we're joined by Isaac Ngama, who is a futurist and foresight strategist. He makes the point, in fact, to say that he belongs to a small number of individuals who are formally qualified in this field. There are only less than 50 universities that offer a degree in strategic foresight. And he joins us, of course, because it is a tool that is used and leaned on by boards, corporations, organizations, governments, many entities, and anyone, in fact, who doesn't want to make the wrong strategic decision. And so today we are going to be looking at some of the dynamics, some of the things that are happening in the world that are going to impact how we do things. So we're talking about the decade beyond COVID. I mean, 2020 concluded the previous decade with the pandemic, and this is how we're starting off a new decade. So what are some of the dynamics in the world that we need to prepare for, be aware of, that are going to shape our lives? Isaac, good afternoon. Thank you so much for joining us.
Good afternoon, Azania, and good afternoon to you and to all of your wonderful listeners.
So let's quickly talk about this practice, being a futurist, foresight strategist. What exactly is it that you do?
Well, I think maybe just to give a very brief background on how it started, it actually was prompted by the Pearl Harbor attacks on the U.S. In World War II. Mm. Where the American Air Force generals were quite surprised as to how they actually missed the fact that the Japanese would be able to attack. And they began working on methodologies for the rest of the war on how to try to anticipate whom may attack them, for what reasons, and what are the probabilities of attacking them in various places, and therefore begin allocating resources accordingly. But it never became a formal field of study. And then in the oil crisis in 1973, when there was a huge crisis and major losses for the oil companies, Shell became the first company to actually implement the issue of wanting to anticipate issues. And it was only in 1979 when the first degrees were actually introduced. So that's really the background of where it comes from.
Yes. So let's now look at some of the dynamics that are shaping our world at the moment and the way in which they're going to continue shaping our world. The first has to do with governments versus corporations, the rise of the corporation. I was taking a look at the recent Edelman Trust Barometer, and trust of governments just continues to decline, and the corporation, in fact, one of the slides says business becomes only trusted institution, and they were measuring or looking at trust in government, in media, in NGOs, and business. And business seems to be garnering or getting a lot of trust at the moment. So what does the picture look like between nation states and multinational corporations?
Well, the nation state is becoming weaker over time, and multinational corporations are becoming a lot stronger. If you look at the top 100 economies in the world, more than half of these are no longer countries, but are instead corporations. And that balance is continuing to tilt towards the corporations. And what is happening now is that the kind of power and influence that many of the corporations have is slowly beginning to manifest itself. And without talking about speaking to whether it was, you know, the political aspects of it, if you look at what has happened in the United States with Twitter and others that have managed to block President Trump and greatly inconvenienced him from being able to speak to some of his followers, and I'm not speaking to the political side of things, but just addressing myself to an example, just a current example of the kind of corporate power that we have. So corporations are beginning to become a lot more important. The danger of that, of course, is that it has some positive aspects to it, but what we are going to see increasingly in the days to come is that this will obviously begin eroding the importance of the vote, because much as it is the corporates that are becoming more powerful, but you as citizens vote for government. And so the people that you vote for, the entities that you vote for, are going to have less power, and those that you do not vote for are going to have more power. And there's, of course, good and bad in that, but that's a conversation on its own.
Yes, that's absolutely a conversation on its own. And also then the role of government. And we need governments that will truly then understand what their role is and how, in fact, to advocate for their citizens in light of this growing power of corporations. That's fascinating. But while we're speaking about elections, I mean, in South Africa, we're having debates about synchronizing local and national government elections. The IEC came out to say that elections will go ahead as planned. How will elections, for instance, be affected moving forward, our ability to vote and how we vote?
Well, it makes absolute sense for elections to become digitized, to become electronic, and that has many advantages. Firstly, elections by their very nature are extremely expensive. You have the printing of the ballot papers, you have their distribution, you have the rental of the venues where the elections are going to take place, the training of the personnel, and many, many other expenses that deal with the infrastructure of conducting these elections. Once you are able to conduct these electronically, you cut out significantly on these costs, and that those resources are able to be reallocated to other issues. But even the environment benefits, because you have less emissions that are coming onto the environment. You have fewer cars that are distributing these ballot papers and trucks, and voters don't have to go to ballot stations to cast their vote. You are cutting less trees to print these ballot papers. But it also has the potential of being beneficial for the government in increasing its mandate, in the sense that you are likely to have a much higher turnover when people are able to vote at their convenience. And I know that there's an issue around, you know, are these kind of elections safe? Yes, they are safe, in the sense that you cannot, as people, feel absolutely okay and safe with handling all your personal financial transactions online, but not feel safe enough to cast your vote, because it's basically the same platforms and the same system. But I guess it has not been properly articulated, and in the same way that we do transact financially.
Yes.
Online.
And I think it links to the previous conversation about trust in government and so on. Work has to be done to improve that. If we turn to economies, you know, our president announced his economic and recovery plan, and the usual suspects of vast infrastructure development rollout countrywide were listed as priorities for and would help to provide growth to our economy. That we're simply not talking enough about new industries, you know, developing new industries. We're still, our GDP, when you look at the contributions, agriculture, resources, and so on. So we are not developing new industries in a way, perhaps, that will allow us to compete successfully. Will we be punished as economies also change?
Azania, the importance of that question you just asked cannot be underestimated. And this is one of the biggest challenges that Africa as a continent, if I speak to Africa just for this question, faces. In the past, most of Africa's economies were based on resources, whether those were mineral resources or agricultural resources, and we were exporting these to the outside world, and that's how it's been. And the prices would fluctuate, and those fluctuations would affect our economies positively or negatively. But what's happening in the new world is that it is innovation that is driving economic growth, and not so much resources. And when we look at innovation, one of the most logical ways of measuring innovation in a society is to measure the amount of the percentage of graduates that we produce annually as a society that come from the science, technology, engineering, and mathematics discipline. And when I mention the STEM in short, and when I mention those STEM, I'm looking at them in their broader perspective.
Mm.
So mathematics, for instance, would include accounting, actuarial sciences. Your science part would include all parts of sciences.
Mm.
Now, those are very important because the vast majority of innovation, which is what will be driving tomorrow's economy, comes from within that environment. Not all of it, but a very significant proportion comes from that. Now, the danger with Africa is that if you look at China, they are producing, in terms of annual graduates, 40% of their annual graduates are coming from the STEM environment. And that's because how they structure their scholarships and some of the deliberate strategies that they do to encourage people to go into those environments.
Mm.
India is sitting at 32%. Western Europe is sitting at 14%, the United States at 17%. In Africa, we are producing on average, of course it differs from country to country, but as a continental average, we are producing only 3% of our graduates that come from the STEM environment. So the disciplines that we need the most, we are producing the least, and those that we already have an oversupply, we are producing more. Now, let me say this. There is nothing as a discipline or a field that is useless. It doesn't exist. Every single field and discipline is useful. What is dangerous is continuing to produce more and more what you already have in oversupply and less in what, or virtually nothing in what you need. And if I could give a very quick analogy, because this is a very important part, I liken this to what I call a chef's economy. If we train the best chefs, we need to remember that regardless of how well trained these chefs are, we need people that are going to, that have to grow the food which the chefs are going to prepare. Because chefs don't grow the food, they only prepare it. Now, likewise, if we train the best administrators, whichever departments they are in, administer aspects of the economy. And if we are not producing people, the skills that are going to grow those economies, what are these very well-trained administrators going to administrate?
Mm.
So, and hence the analogy of a chef's economy. And the danger with Africa is we are training a lot of chefs and not training the people that will grow the food for the chefs to grow, if I could use that analogy.
Right. Sobering. Absolutely sobering. Let's move on to other serious matters like many of us have been quite concerned. The 31st of January, in fact, marks the end of the 350 Rand COVID-19 relief grant, right? And there's lots of concern that people are going to be increasingly desperate. The economy is not creating jobs, and therefore opportunities to be able to earn a livelihood are simply not there. So the risks of rising inequality in the world, as we hear of the wealth of people like Elon Musk, like Jeff Bezos, and so on, as more and more people, in fact, are being pushed into the poverty line, especially with the impact of the pandemic. Are we likely to see rising inequality? And what is that impact going to be? What is the impact likely to be on society?
Well, yes. I will look at the impact from two perspectives. Firstly, the impact for individuals, and then secondly, the impact for government.
Mm.
If we start with individuals, inequality by its very nature breeds extremism. Extremism leads to divisions. Divisions lead to social stresses. And it is these stresses that we should be concerned, because they manifest themselves in so many ways in terms of society. We have a society now where increasingly in the days to come, we are going to witness a lot more psychological problems because of the many different stresses that people are going to go through. And these will manifest themselves in so many ways, higher divorce rates and so on. So the inequality that we have in the world has to be addressed, because if it is not addressed, it becomes an inherent danger to our continued social stability. And no society regardless of how well-defined its strategies are, can grow as well as it can if it has all kinds of social stresses. And this inequality poses one of the biggest threats to stability, especially in countries where inequality is already high, Brazil and South Africa being points, you know, cases in point. Now, if we move on to their impact on government, around the world, there has been a significant decline in economic activity, specifically because of the current situation. That has led governments, in terms of their revenue collections, to collect a lot less. But at the same time, the higher levels of unemployment, of economic stresses that people are going through, of retrenchments, companies closing down because of the current situation, have put an extraordinary amount of pressure on the government and what government has to do for its citizens. So on one hand, government is collecting less revenue because of lower economic activities in general. But on the other hand, the needs and expectations of these governments is a lot higher. And so governments all of a sudden have to learn to do more with less. That will call for governments to operate a lot more efficiently. It will call for a complete change in strategy, in how they do things. Mm. It may even call for such drastic measures as the sizes of governments, and I'm not referring to any particular country, but just generally around the world. Because for the next few years, while the economy has to get back on its feet, governments are going to be collecting less, yet expected to do a lot more with less. Right. And all the combination of all those things is not a very pretty picture.
Precisely. So it's going to be, from the sounds of things, quite a difficult decade ahead as we try and stabilize and emerge from the impact of the pandemic. But before we wrap, I just quickly want to squeeze in our friends, the Chinese. How will this friendship with Africa develop? Because I know that you've elucidated or given views on the dynamics at play in the US, in Europe with its aging population and South and Africa's younger population. But if we quickly just spend the minute that we have left on Africa's relationship and friendship with China, how are things likely to develop there and what sort of impact would they have?
Well, there are already underlying questions from many African countries, but these are at the moment quite silent on the one-sided nature of relations between Africa and the Chinese. So a lot of how things are structured at the moment initially looked like they were very good for Africa, but increasingly it is becoming clear that in some countries there are very high levels of indebtedness, and this is creating major, major problems. So these differences with China, which are currently brewing under the table, are going to become increasingly open. But that's not entirely such a bad thing for Africa, because what that would lead to is the United States, Europe, and China all competing for Africa's attention. And that may lead to Africa getting much better terms in terms of not only financial and economic assistance, but also in terms of some of the structuring of the trade deals that Africa has. So the current relationship with China is going to undergo some stresses. I must say here, though, much as we have concentrated on some of the negatives and some of the challenges that we are to face this decade, that there are also some positive developments, especially on the technology side and many other aspects. Mm. And we can look at some of those at another stage. So there are many, many challenges, but there are also many opportunities that will be in front of us in the decade ahead.
Yes, let's do that. Let's do that. We'll find an opportunity to look at the positive side of things. Thank you so much, Isaac. It's been lovely chatting to you.
Thank you to you and to all your listeners.
Thank you. That's Isaac Nkama. He is a futurist and foresight strategist. And so really, it's an indispensable practice for governments, for boards, corporations, even for ourselves as we look into the next decade. Someone was listening quite closely and wants to talk about when a decade starts and when a decade ends. I wonder what your thoughts are. And this comes from Tamsanga. He says, there's been much debate about when the old decade ends and the new one begins. Some say the old decade ended on December the 31st, 2019. And the start of the new one began on January the 1st, 2020. For others, the new decade doesn't start until the 1st of January, 2021. Food for thought. I started on the 1st of January, 2021. Yes, now, this last January 2021. I thought the new decade started there. When did you start the new decade?